This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
This fine podcast is a proud member of the Rabble Podcast Network, which is a hand-picked collection of Canadian podcasts on Rabble.ca that offer an alternative take on politics, society, community, and life in general. Rabble.ca is a non-profit, community-funded media site, and they need your support to keep going. Please help out at rabble.ca/donate. Your support helps podcasts like this get out to the world.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO at 100.5 FM. The U.S. Pentagon has recently admitted that Taliban attacks in Afghanistan are not waning. Indeed, last year, those attacks remained steady, or in some cases increased over levels from the year 2011. One of the factors that may be driving this trend is oil. Although not mentioned in the Pentagon's report, it's what Antonia Juhas experienced firsthand when she was in Afghanistan last November. Oil in Afghanistan is not only attracting overseas conglomerates, it's also attracting local resistance. Antonia Juhas is the author of Black Tide and The Tyranny of Oil. Last week, Red Eye Collective member Sean Mullins spoke with her about recent developments in Afghanistan. Sean began by asking her about the available reserves of oil there.
Well, you know, I've written extensively on the fact that I think that one of the primary driving factors for the war in Iraq was its oil resources. They're among the largest in the world, probably in the top three, if not in the top, after Saudi Arabia. And that, however, is not the case for Afghanistan. I certainly don't think that it was the top of our list for the U.S. invasion. And the reserves in Afghanistan are really nothing in comparison to Iraq. Iraq has about 116 billion barrels of oil. Afghanistan has about 1.6 billion. Its natural gas reserves are larger, but they're still very small in comparison. That said, you know, at this stage of the world, basically any oil and natural gas is oil and natural gas that somebody is going to want and somebody is going to fight over. And the fighting over it part is one of the things that we're seeing in Afghanistan today. Also, Afghanistan is very strategically located in terms of the oil and gas reserves of the nations around it. It's near countries like Turkmenistan, and also Afghanistan is an important player in terms of whether it's stable or not and how that stability or lack thereof impacts the stability of the oil and natural gas-rich nations around it. So within that context, its oil and gas and the oil and gas near it is important and is an important contributing factor to the ongoing war.
Who are the players involved? Who are the possible participants in the development and the production of Afghan oil? Or is it too early to say at this stage?
The original development of Afghan oil and natural gas started with the Soviet occupation, and the Russians worked with Afghans to initiate the development of this sector in the 60s and in the 70s. They sort of got things going, and then there was too much war and too much war fighting to keep things going, and what you've got is the sort of nascent beginnings of an oil and gas sector. There's very, very limited development occurring in natural gas prior to the U.S.-led invasion. There is a great deal of knowledge. There was a lot of training that was done by the Russians and continued education that was done among Afghans. They have state-run agencies for natural gas and a lot of will to do the work on their own. After the 2001 invasion, it was a priority for the U.S. government across all of the country to push for privatization and foreign investment, including in the natural gas sector. And you know, it was sort of happening in fits and starts. The real focus of the U.S. government was Iraq once that invasion happened, and particularly when you're talking about oil and gas, Iraq's resources. So things didn't really start going in Afghanistan probably until 2009, which is when the U.S. Pentagon took the lead in pushing for the development of this sector. And in 2010, the U.S. Pentagon led well helped the Afghan Ministry of Mines lead, although I would say that they did it, the first post-war tender for an oil production contract. And that contract, even though the Pentagon was trying to figure out how to get U.S. companies that had expressed their desire to operate in Afghanistan, like Exxon and Chevron, to try to get them in, things were just still too unstable and remain so today. So the first company that actually got an oil production contract in Afghanistan was the China National Petroleum Company, CNPC, much to the chagrin of some key political players in the United States who really thought that one of the reasons why we went to war was to get the bounty of that war, including the oil. Right now, the attention to the sector, which has continued, I was just there in mid-November for a new oil and gas bidding round that the Pentagon was still behind, trying to get more companies in. The attention of the U.S. government on this sector, my experience showed, was attracting the attention of the Taliban and attracting Taliban violence. And that's what I experienced when I traveled across the country for about 3 weeks in October and November.
You did go to Afghanistan recently, and you wrote about that in an article in the Atlantic Monthly. First of all, where did you travel in Afghanistan?
So I traveled across the northern provinces and over to the west, as far west as Herat, which is on the Iranian border, and really across all the provinces of the north, but I was unable to go to Kunduz because it just was becoming way too violent as I was traveling. And this is an area that is supposed to be relatively safe. It's been under the control of warlords who have kept the Taliban out for most of the post-U.S. invasion period. And, it's been relatively calm, certainly in comparison to the south, which is very much under Taliban control. And so I was following a map of oil and gas initially created by the Russians and then redone by the Americans. And the Americans had just recently been on sort of a similar trek that I had been on, so I was traveling in their footsteps, going to find out, where are the villages where this oil and gas is located? What do the people who live there know about the potential development of this sector? What do they think about it? What do these resources look like today? And as I was doing that journey, I basically kept having extreme near misses with Taliban attacks, including one deadly attack. And what became increasingly clear to me was that essentially the Taliban were using the same map that I was, and they were targeting the oil and gas sector and trying to keep the development of this sector out of the hands of the Americans, keep it from being something that would look good for the Karzai administration, keep the benefits from it out of the hands of their rivals. The more I experienced this, the more that I started asking about it and had my hypotheses confirmed by a representative who was a consultant who was working on the bidding round for the U.S. Pentagon, by the leading NGO in Afghanistan that works on this sector, Integrity Watch Afghanistan, and it just became clear that really as the U.S. increased its attention, so too were the Taliban.
And again, this was in an area that, this is not an area where the, which is home to the Taliban. This is in a more northern region.
Yeah, I mean, yes, so the south is the traditional home and base where Kandahar is located of the Taliban, but the Taliban have been all over the country and have certainly had deadly activity even in the north. But since 2001, the north has been an area that has been relatively calm and has not seen as much Taliban activity. Now, that said, that the point that I'm making in the article isn't oil and gas is the reason why there's a Taliban resurgence in Afghanistan. Rather, one of the pieces contributing to that resurgence, which is happening all over Afghanistan, one of the contributing factors is oil and gas.
Do you think it's possible that the development of oil and gas in Afghanistan may actually prolong the American presence there and the Canadian as well?
It has a risk of doing that, most certainly, because anything that increases instability lends to the argument that the foreign military presence is needed to keep the peace. And, you know, basically what happened in Iraq was there were many people who wanted the U.S. military occupation to continue, wanted foreign military contractors to stay, but at the end of the day, President Obama could not negotiate an agreement with the Iraqis that would grant immunity to foreign soldiers, or U.S. soldiers in our case, or U.S. Contract workers working in Iraq. If they broke the law, they were going to have to face Iraq's legal system. And so really, the vast majority of the foreign military presence, the foreign contractor presence is now gone from Iraq because of that. President Obama has said that he's going to bring all the U.S. forces home. President Karzai, who I think knows that his continued presidency may very well depend on that foreign military presence, has said he wants to try and see the military occupation continue, and he's willing to negotiate an agreement that'll make it possible if he can convince his cabinet to do so and the parliament that he would want to basically grant that immunity that was being sought in Iraq. We don't know if that's going to happen or not, but basically the door is certainly open for the potential for continued foreign military presence after the status of forces agreement is supposed to expire. And anything that contributes to instability would add to the argument that there needs to be a continued foreign military presence. So by advancing the development of this sector, particularly in my mind by having the U.S. Pentagon lead it, because I mean it's just asking for trouble. I mean, first of all, oil and gas is a volatile resource regardless. It is a resource over which countries and companies and people fight, and they fight endlessly for it. It's also a resource which has been dubbed suffering from the resource curse. Countries that are more dependent on their oil and gas for their economic base tend to be the least economically secure and the least stable. Also, you know, in the middle of a foreign occupation, to have the occupier lead the development of such a volatile resource just to be asking for trouble, which it is, in fact, getting. In addition, so let's say an Exxon or a Chevron starts operating in Afghanistan. Is there anyone who thinks that the Taliban wouldn't be attracted to that as a potential source of violence? And, you know, wouldn't that then argue that Exxon and Chevron would say, yeah, if we're going to come operate in this country, you know, we will most certainly want a required military or at a minimum foreign contractor presence to protect our operations, and that could also continue the occupation as well. You know, so in my mind, this development at this time is certainly threatening the security of Afghans. It's also threatening the security of the foreign troops that are there, and as you asked, I think it could also lead to a continuation of the occupation, which is something I really don't think that Americans want, and I really don't think Canadians want as well. And on top of all of that, while there's been a lot of attention by the U.S. government and the World Bank and other groups to opening up this sector to privatization and to foreign investment, there has been just basically zero concurrent attention paid to developing the regulatory capacity to say, okay, let's do say you start producing oil and gas. You know, that is a resource that is very harmful to the environment, to human rights, to economic justice, and there's zero regulatory capacity, zero, in the Afghan government to deal with those outcomes. So, for example, I went and interviewed the president of the National Environmental Protection Agency in Afghanistan, and it's exciting that he exists and that there is this agency. And there are some good laws on the books, in fact. But let's say, for example, monitoring, you know, air quality, which is very important, one of the environmental harms of oil and gas production. And he said, yeah, you know, we've got some good laws on air quality, but in order to measure that, you need devices that measure air quality, and we have one. And that device is sitting in the parking lot right in front of me in Kabul. That's the only machine they have in the entire country that has the capacity to measure at all, anywhere, air quality. So that, you know, capacity for oversight, the capacity for regulation just absolutely doesn't exist.
I want to go back to something you said earlier, which was that the Pentagon is the would be the main manager of this development. How is that supposed to work exactly?
Well, they're not the main manager. So, you know, they will tell you it is the Afghan Ministry of Mines that is doing this work. And what they are doing is the Pentagon is driving the U.S. government's interest in this sector and in supporting the Ministry of Mines in its efforts. So there are hundreds of employees that have been hired by the U.S. government to assist in the writing of new laws in Afghanistan for oil and gas, to work within the ministries to guide the tender process for putting these oil and gas contracts onto the market, for teaching the Afghans about privatization, about foreign investment, like I said, changing the legal system. Basically, consultants of and employees of hired by the U.S. Pentagon have infiltrated the Afghan government to move this process along, and they have certainly put the Afghan government as a public face. But a lot of the nuts and bolts are essentially being done by the Pentagon officials and their consultants. And you know, one of the things they did, I interviewed several people who used to work for the Afghan Ministry of Mines, engineers and others who had worked for the ministry for 30 years. Who have been very interested in seeing this sector develop, but would like to see it stay under state control, like most of their neighbors in Central Asia and the Middle East, and to potentially sign technical service agreements with foreign companies to get the expertise that they lack for, you know, not having done these operations for 30 years, but to keep it as a state-run effort as opposed to a privatized effort. And many of those people were fired, and many people believe that they were pushed out of the advice of the U.S. government that wants to see this sector privatized, not remain nationalized, and that's part of the job that the Pentagon has set itself out to achieve. And this all fits into a broader agenda put in place by the Bush administration in both Iraq and Afghanistan very early on, which is the process that's been called the militarization of development, whereby the Department of Defense or the Pentagon has really taken over very traditional development activities that frequently happen in war that are led by the U.S. Agency for International Development, led by NGOs, led by the State Department, but instead have been taken over by the Pentagon and really tried to infuse a war-winning agenda into what would traditionally just be a development agenda. So while the U.S. Pentagon taking over an oil and gas sounds outrageous, and it is, and sounds like just a pretty literal, you know, embodiment of war and oil, it's also a bizarre natural outcome of this broader process whereby the Pentagon has really taken over development in both Iraq and Afghanistan.
That was Red Eye Collective member Sean Mullen interviewing author Antonia Yuhas. Antonia is a fellow at the Investigative Reporting Program at the University of California, Berkeley, in the Graduate School of Journalism. She is the author of Black Tide and The Tyranny of Oil. Her recent article on Afghanistan and oil can be found in the January edition of The Atlantic Monthly.
This podcast was produced by the Red Eye Collective in Vancouver, BC. If you live in the Vancouver area and are interested in creating alternative radio with us, we'd love to hear from you. Contact us at redeye@coopradio.org.